Come over here, kid. Why, sir? You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see, you start out with a little bit of water, and you fry some garlic. Then you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. You got it to a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. And a little bit of wine. Sugar, and that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce.
I eat with gusto, damn your bet, my country tis of thee. I eat for social progress, I eat for victory.
Delicious.
Stay hungry, stay hungry, stay hungry.
You want some more?
Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, the Wine Country's most delicious hour here on KRCB. It's Michelle Anna Jordan. Hope you've had a great weekend. You know what? I'm going to move over just one second. I have to turn up my headphones. Let's see. Yes, that worked. Now I sound better. You know, there's all kinds of technical things that go on behind the scenes. And you should see me. I am such a mess. I'm sorry I did not dress up for the occasion. You know, I got most of the paint stains off my hands, but I spent today painting my kitchen. It was so fun. And we have a really fun show. But before we get to tonight's show, I have to say, happy anniversary, Joey. Joey is a miniature long-haired dachshund who came to live with me exactly 2 years ago today. His human, he was born, I think, in Springfield, Missouri. And in, let's see, he was born in October of 2000. And in, let's see, November of 2009, his human, a woman who's only 73, died suddenly of a heart attack. And Joey and his the other dachshund he lived with, whose name I can't say because Joey's here in the studio with me, and if I say the name, he'll perk up and he'll start looking for her, and then I'll start crying because it's just so sad to see that. They lived in a shelter for 2 months, and until her daughter, this woman's daughter who lives in Berkeley, she drove to Springfield, Missouri, picked up both of the dachshunds, drove back to Berkeley, and she and her partner, they have huskies, I think it is. I think it's huskies, and so they couldn't keep the dachshunds. And one day, I was just taking the kind of break from writing where I just needed to clear my head. I couldn't go into another room, but I needed to do something different. So I just thought, oh, I'll look at pictures of dachshunds. And I just went to a dachshund rescue site. I didn't even know which one, and there was this little boy named Joey. And it said Berkeley, and usually they would say, like, oh, Virginia, Georgia, whatever. I thought, oh, I wonder if this is for real, and I sent an email. And she sent an email back, and it was a real person, and she said, you know, we love Sebastopol. We'd be happy to bring him up for a play date. And they brought him up a few days later, and it was like a blind date. I sat on the couch, you know, because, like, oh, I don't want to be aggressive. I just want to see if the dog likes me. And he sat next to them. And then at one point, he walked over, and you have to picture this dog's legs are like 2.5 inches long. And he jumped onto the couch next to me. They were astonished. And they had snuck me a couple little treats. And I'm not a dog person. I've never had a dog before. Not really. And I was the first stranger he took a treat from. And I got up to go into the other room to look for the cats. And when I came back, they says, oh, my God, he just got up on the back of the couch. He looked for you. Like, where did she go? So it was the sort of blind date that was love at first sight. And they stayed for about half an hour. And they says, well, you know, the shelter down in Albany or Oakland, they says the shelter thinks they can place him. So we're going to get his teeth cleaned on Wednesday. And just let us know by Friday. If it's not right for you, that's fine, because the shelter will be able to place him. And I went to bed that night and I dreamed about him. And it's like, I got up, I was like, bring me my dog. So they brought him to me the day of the Super Bowl 2 years ago. I'd never watched a Super Bowl, but I had it on because it was New Orleans, and I love New Orleans, and I just wanted to honor New Orleans by having it on. And all of a sudden, there's like, I have no idea who I am anymore. I have a dog, and I'm watching football. Anyway, Joey has been the biggest, most inspirational joy in my life in a really, really long time. I have learned so much about, oh, God, I've just learned so much about so many things. Learning how to interact and understand the language of a species I really didn't know that much about. I can interact with cats really well. I understand cats. But learning about this little dachshund has just been amazing. Learning to cook for it, because I make his food now. He's on a raw diet. And we're going to actually do a show about making your own food for either your dog or your cat or whomever. Anyway, I just had to say publicly happy anniversary to Joey, and I got all misty-eyed, and he's here at my feet. He loves the radio. He loves coming to radio stations. And I'm not really that far off topic with tonight's guests, which have been inspired for several reasons. We have with us Veronica Bowers of the Songbird Hospital. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
And also I have to say, you know, if that was like, Veronica Bowers, but no, all of a sudden I'm thinking about chocolate, yes. This is Veronica Bowers of La Dolce V, who makes the absolute best chocolate confections, the chocolate bonbons that I've ever tasted. She's remarkable. Not doing that now and devoting her time to a very, very important endeavor, and that is saving songbirds. So we'll be talking a lot about that. We also have how many times you've been on, Mouthful's former producer, Frederic Lavoisier, founder of a little witch is in the room, a former producer of Mouthful, founder of Insectapalooza, director of...
Well, now I'm the student engagement coordinator, and it's entomology outreach and garden classroom.
Garden classroom, great, at Sonoma State University. Yes. And you were involved with, was it the sustainability certificate? Was that it?
I was the founding director of the Sustainable Landscape Program there, and I'm still teaching in that.
Cool. So part of what is has inspired tonight is, you know, I think we have to face it. It's a drought year. You know, we're in a drought cycle. I've lived through 1 7-year drought and 1 8-year drought in Sonoma County. I recognize the signs, and the signs are not simply lack of water. Mm-hmm. It smells differently. Plants act differently. Birds act, you know, everything is different. And, you know, I keep thinking, no, we're going to have a late winter. You know, it's a drought cycle. So we're going to talk about that. And we'll probably do more than one show. I'd like to get Robert Corrick, who wasn't available tonight. I'd like to get Robert in because he does so much about water preservation, you know, about not being an idiot when it comes to your garden and water. But it's a drought cycle. So what does that mean in your garden? One of the things that I recall about drought cycles is it is often much, much colder than in rainy years. What does that mean as far as your plants? I've lost a lot of things back in a really bad freeze, and I think it was 91. What does it mean about birds? Do we need to be more concerned and giving them more food because there's something that's like, uh-oh, it's cold, what are we going to eat? Or are they somewhere else? So that's sort of all the things that have brought up tonight's topic. And if you're sitting there saying, hey, that's not about food, well, of course it is. Because everything, you know, everything is connected, and the more closely and passionately you follow the sort of philosophy that Mouthful has, certainly Mouthful is not the only one, but that eating close to the earth, of course, everything about the earth affects what you eat. On that note, welcome to Mouthful.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So what do you think? Am I right about this drought?
I think you are, and we were just talking about that a couple of days ago, my husband and I, about there's a certain feeling to it, and that the people who say, oh, it's going to rain, I think they're wrong.
Yeah. It might rain a little.
Well, it's going to rain a little. I think it won't rain enough.
Yeah. And what are we about? know a couple of weeks ago we were as much as 75% below seasonal normal, and I haven't checked the figures.
I don't think it's much different than that.
Okay.
Now.
Yeah.
So, and you know, one of the things I find really irksome when I read or hear about our impending drought is, well, we don't really have to worry because the reservoirs are almost full, and that is just so human-centered. Yes, water will still come out of our taps, but there are a lot of other organisms out there.
Yeah. Plus, our population, I mean, I don't have the exact figures, but the last multi-year drought ended in December of 93. There was this horrible New Year's flood, and the drought ended. So we've actually had, since then, we've had really more than 15 years of above-average rainfall. And during that time, not only has the human population increased tremendously, so have vineyards that suck up a lot of water.
Right.
People have no idea what life is like in the Bay Area during an extended drought if they haven't been here. Water doesn't always come out of every tap.
No.
I remember things that I always think of, and it's odd because it wasn't a huge influence on my life, but a really good friend of mine was cleaning houses, as a lot of us did in the 70s, in Marin County, and she went on vacation. And so I filled in for her, and I was cleaning these huge, spotless houses in Marin. And I remember this one for a doctor up in the hills in San Rafael. I was given a bucket with 1 inch of water in the bucket. That was my water. I was not allowed to turn on a tap. I had a bunch of towels, and I had some spray cleansers, but I had this 1 inch of water.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it didn't surprise me. It wasn't a shock. Yeah. And they had the charts in the bathrooms.
Yes.
I know they certainly had those charts at UC Berkeley, and it was the color of the water, and you did not flush until, you know, it reached a certain color.
I remember that. I was living in Corte Madera at that time.
Oh, yeah. Right. Absolutely.
Yes, absolutely.
I remember, people feeling competitive about how dirty their car was. You know, mine is dirtier than yours.
You were a really good conservationist if your car was super dirty.
So let's start with birds, because I think... I mean, partly because I work at home, and I have bird feeders right outside my window, and I'm always paying attention. So, and the other thing I noticed, I think on your Facebook page, Veronica, you said songbird season has started.
It has.
Is it early? It seems early.
There are some interesting things going on out there that are occurring much earlier than in previous years. Anna's hummingbirds and barn owls, they're always early nesters. That's just the way they roll. So that's really typical. What seems earlier this year for me is that our nesting Anna's hummingbird on the Songbird Hospital property, she actually has babies in her nest.
Wow.
So she's not just nest building. She's done with that. She's done incubating her eggs. Her babies have hatched, and she is actively feeding them.
Wow. That gives me chills.
Yeah. So that's a little earlier than usual, because typically our Anna's hummingbirds on our property in Sebastopol, they're feeding babies about the end of February, beginning of March. So this is almost an entire month early. Other things that are happening right now is the chickadees are doing courtship interactions, the titmice are, the bewick's wrens are singing their hearts out, the robins are. Today I saw some very interesting interaction between two male robins. So their hormones seem to be surging really early right now. And it's, I think, you know, they're taking some cues in the environment that are telling them, okay,
time to
time to get into action here.
Yeah.
And also the other most startling thing that I saw last weekend when I was down in Morro Bay for a meeting is I was staying in a hotel one block away from the shoreline. And at about 8:30 in the morning, 12 barn swallows flew past my balcony. And I've watched barn swallows a couple of times migrating up the Pacific Coast in Costa Rica in March and April. And the formation of these barn swallows that I saw in Morro Bay and their contact calls and the way they were flying with such northbound intention. they were not just overwintering swallows in the Central Coast. These birds were migrating. They were heading northbound. And that's crazy early for swallows. Uh-huh. So we often see tree swallows here in Sonoma County throughout the winter. They're pretty hardy. Some will stay. Some will go south. But the barn swallows, most of them them try and head out of town and spend their winter south in Mexico or Central America.
Wow, so and they're coming up here already.
Yeah, these guys were definitely migrating north. So for me, those are startling observations mm-hmm. when we think about drought and climate change and how it affects our birds.
Mm-hmm. And what about finches? I now have finch socks.
Yeah.
And they're full. I mean, I don't mean the socks are full. The birds they're full of birds nibbling on the Niger seed.
Right.
Is this the right time of year for them?
This is the right time of year.
Okay.
Yeah, this is normal behavior for the finches. Typically what you'll see is their feeder activity for the goldfinch and house finches will sort of dwindle in the summer months because a lot of their native natural foods are mm-hmm. more abundant. Mm-hmm. So they're a little less interested in the seed feeders at that time. But right now, yeah, they're gorging. And I think, too, with the colder weather that mm-hmm. we've been having, they just kind of park it on those feeders. And they don't seem to stray too far because uh-huh. they're really having to refuel their bodies so quickly.
Yeah. Now, also, many years ago, maybe 15 years ago, I put suet out, mm-hmm. suet out, melted in the sun. Nobody ever ate it. But number one, I found some suet that doesn't melt in the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And also some that mammals won't eat. This was so interesting. Wild Birds Unlimited,
yes.
God, they know so much. And I stopped by and we got to talking because I'm not putting out regular bird seed right now because mm-hmm. of rodents.
Yeah, that does attract them.
Yes, and I just suffered through a terrifying infestation.
Mm-hmm.
Really terrifying.
Right.
And so it's like, okay, I'm going to fill my hummingbird feeder, I'll do the Niger seed. And so I was
yes.
talking to this guy, and what they've done is they add cayenne
mm-hmm.
to suet. Cayenne and seed.
Yeah.
But I thought, well, they never ate before, so maybe I just don't have birds that want it.
Mm-hmm.
It's half gone.
Mm-hmm.
It's been there 2 weeks, it's half gone, and I don't know, I haven't caught anybody there yet.
All
but
right.
clearly someone's eating it.
Very good. Yeah, birds have very few taste buds, so the hot pepper doesn't bother them
yeah.
in the least. But mammals, as you know, they have taste buds very similar to ours, so if they get a hold of that, they're very offended by it.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's a good tip. If you want to feed your animals, but if you want to feed your birds, but not the squirrels and not the not the ratatouilles that might be around.
Right.
Yes. Check out Wild Birds Unlimited and check out their cayenne suet, because
mm-hmm.
I've just been thrilled. I'm going to catch them. I'm going to find out who it is. But it's just really gratifying to see that, okay, somebody's eating it.
Yeah.
That's really fun.
Definitely.
Yeah. So let's bring what you're doing right now. What different things do you have to do in the garden, and what actually should people be thinking about if they garden at home? Because I know it's colder. It's drier.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have to feed my? Do I have to water my outside plants at this time of year? What do I need to do?
It actually came as kind of a shock to me. I was not surprised that I had to water my garden in Sebastopol, which is sandy soil. What was surprising to me is the garden at Sonoma State, which is in adobe,
mm-hmm.
and that's a very fertile soil, but it's also soil that holds onto water really well,
mm-hmm.
and it has been improved with organic matter, which also holds onto water, and mulched, and we were watering to keep things alive, and that was quite shocking to me.
Yeah.
The other thing, and maybe I'm wrong about this, Veronica, but we have bird baths in our yard,
mm-hmm.
and I actually like birds
a lot,
too.
We all should have bird baths.
And but what I started seeing is that these birds were coming in and drinking the water, just bathing in it. And
is there a problem for birds getting enough water to drink?
I don't know how much of a problem it is, but I've actually had the same observation that Frederic has, and that, during the summer, we're very accustomed to seeing them drink a lot
mm-hmm.
out of the bird baths. But during the winter, really, most of my observations are, they're bathing. They are drinking. They are drinking out of the baths, and it's why, I don't know, probably because they're not finding water sources out there naturally. So they're really making a destination point of the bird mm-hmm. bath for water.
Wow, that's really interesting.
Mm-hmm. So I was very interested that you were having Veronica on because the garden at Sonoma State, we've been very focused on birds in the last year. And partly we had a graduate student who's now finished, and he was studying grasslands. But in his spare time, every lunch, he went out and he looked for birds. And so he made this list.
Oh, really?
Yes, all the birds.
Oh, my gosh, this gives me chills.
On campus. And if you look at the chart on the next page, he came and spoke. We have a habitat day, and he came and spoke there, and 70% of birds eat insects. And
what's a frugivore?
They eat fruit.
Oh, frug, okay.
Frugivore, fruit.
It's fruit, okay.
And, you know, and I think a lot of people don't know that. And so when you talk about, you know, the bird seed, you're only attracting about 30% of the bird mm-hmm. species with bird seed.
And plus, yeah. What's also interesting about this, and I know that a lot of people, farmers, mm-hmm. Certain farmers, grape growers, consider birds
pests.
And I was shocked. I know you told me this before, but when you mentioned it again, I was like, oh, you can kill finches without a penalty.
Yeah, oh. The Agricultural Commissioner's Department up there, all growers need to do is actually just apply for a little permit, and then they can set traps on their property and take an unlimited number of house finches. And they're actually required by the stipulation of the permit to euthanize them. And
not relocate them.
No. Although there is one grower that sends them down to the Golden Gate Raptor Observatory and uses the live finches as bait to...
It's like, can we just send them to Napa?
Right. Actually, Napa kills more house finches on record than Sonoma Valley.
Being a
And then that bird netting, too, right?
Right, and the netting.
No, is the netting detrimental? Oh, it is? How is it a hazard?
It is, yeah, because what happens is when there's fruit on the vine, and we have a number of bird species who are residents here, but also migratory birds coming through, they often will fuel up on fruit because it packs on their migratory fat a lot better sometimes than mm-hmm. the insects do. So they are very determined, and when they light onto the netting, they often get their tangled, their feet entangled, or when they're trying to get their heads through the netting to get to the fruit,
they get strangled.
Yeah, they become mm-hmm. entangled with their, you know, around their wing, around mm-hmm. their neck, etc.
From a practical point of view, what can farmers, whether they're grape farmers or whatever, what's a better approach?
Well, you know, I had a really interesting conversation a couple of years ago from a permaculturist who brought me an injured bird. And I was asking her, you know, about this, and I don't actually even know how we got onto the subject of it. But she said, you know, her philosophy is that you plant enough for yourself and you plant enough for nature. And I thought that's a really sensible idea.
I know people that do that for gophers.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, too, if you look at it, from a business perspective, you always build in an acceptable amount of loss.
Sure.
Right? It doesn't matter what your product is. And so I think that might be a good philosophy and uh-huh. business model for our grape growers to embrace instead of spending so much time and money trying to
they spend
kill
a
our
fortune
native birds.
Trying. Yeah. And I don't know where house finches fit into the local ecology. You know, I don't know where they, and that's one thing I feel like I'm really lacking on the overall concept mm-hmm. of where birds fit in, other than certainly they're pollinators, they're seed dispersers.
Right.
And it's probably selfish, but they bring a lot of joy. Mm-hmm. You know, I love birds, but I know that they're also more important. They eat insects.
They do eat some insects. Uh-huh. So a couple of things. One, you pointed out their primary ecological niches. They mm-hmm. definitely are important seed dispersers. Mm-hmm. They probably do assist in some pollination. They definitely do ingest some insect matter. And I think for me, all of that's extremely important. But the other most important thing in terms of somebody who is an avid birder who also spent a number of years working with children through the Junior Audubon program is that the house finch is our most common feeder bird. And for many people who aren't familiar with birds, that's their first experience and their first entry point into the joy of birds. And so, you know, I honor the house finch for a whole bunch of reasons, if mm-hmm. not for that one singular reason.
Sure.
Because
now, what color is a house finch?
Well, the males have this lovely little red breast and red hood over their head.
Okay, I know exactly
what
it is.
The females look very similar to them. They just don't have the red.
The red, okay, yeah. I know exactly what
they're
they
totally
are.
They're totally cheerful, really cute. Yeah. Sweet, energetic birds.
I have a lot of greenish-yellow finches at my house.
Oh, you have lesser goldfinches at
yes.
your house.
Yes, yes, they're nice. The ones that are hanging on the Niger
right.
seed stock.
Right. You know, and actually I wanted to go back to something that Frederic said about the gardens and that wonderful list that Andy made up about what birds eat. And absolutely, particularly with songbirds, all of our songbirds are dependent on insect matter at some point or another in their life. If they're not obligate insectivores, like a swallow, for example, or a wren, then that's all they eat are insects. Then maybe 50% of or 60% of their diet are insects, but all of them raise their babies on insects. So insects are really, really important.
Uh-huh.
Really important.
Then if you're somebody who's still putting insecticides on your garden, then you're,
what
I mean,
about that, Frederic?
And there are so many people still doing that.
Right. And, well, you know, I really have come to believe that insecticides in a garden are completely unnecessary. And, you know, of course, if you have a garden and that all you have is lawn and maybe some of those hybrid roses with a lot of petals, a couple of junipers, you're going to have insect problems. But if you've planted the right things and you've planted them in the right way, insects are simply part of what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I always find it interesting to people who I talk to and say, I want to plant a butterfly garden. And I say, good, you know, I have this really great list of host plants for caterpillars. Oh, I don't want caterpillars. That's how, you know, and usually where that conversation goes is that you don't have to put these host plants right next to your front door. And also that there are many plants that are hosts for caterpillars that you're not even noticing.
Mm-hmm.
And that those
I need some. Actually, I need some host plants for caterpillars. Mm-hmm. I've got a lot of butterfly bushes, right. But I really need some host plants.
Yeah. Well, I have a great list for you.
Excellent.
And you know, my feeling about a garden is that I want to fill it with life. And what you said about everything being connected is so true. You know, the insects are food for the fish. They're food for the birds. The birds are food for something else. Mm-hmm. Everything eats something else.
Yeah. How do gophers fit into all this?
Barnacles.
That's right, barnacles.
And you know, I wanted to ask Veronica a question, if you don't mind, because my husband, I found this wonderful pamphlet. Santa Clara Audubon had this online, and
wonderful.
It was how to build a barn owl box.
Oh, cool.
So I hassled my husband, Bob, for some time, and he just finished building me 2 barn owl houses.
Oh, excellent.
Fantastic.
But then you were saying that they nest early. So am I too late now with my barn owl houses?
Not necessarily. Okay. You may get a second, you know, somebody scouting around for a second clutch location or even a roost spot for youngsters after they fledge and become independent. Sometimes it takes a while for a family to move into a new box. And sometimes it happens immediately. So, and we never know exactly what the criteria is that they're looking
That's
for.
That's so true. You can't put something out. Like when I was in Mississippi in December and early January, we went to Mississippi's, Hattiesburg, Mississippi's year-round farmer's market. Oh my gosh. It's so different than here. Somebody had a couple of cabbages and a few bags of kale. There were 3 or 4 vendors of jams and condiments. A woman had cakes. It was huge. There was room for probably 40 vendors. There were probably 7. But one guy had to be in his 70s, maybe his 80s, did woodwork. And he had just the best bird feeder. And it was something where you screwed a mason, you filled up the mason jar and then inverted it, and he had it all worked out, and it was $15. So I bought it for Nicole and Tom. We set it up, and they have a huge, huge, huge yard. And after 2 days, it's like, well, there's no birds. It's like, give it time. Give it time. Nicole called me yesterday. It's been a month and a half, a little bit more than a month and a half, and it's filled. I was surprised it's filled with finches.
Okay.
Even though it's not Niger seed, they're just all these finches. Right. She says, we have birds now. It takes a while. It really can, you know, it takes a while.
It's been my experience with bird baths as well, that, you know, they have to be positioned in a place that the birds like, first of all, where they can watch out for danger. But that a couple times we've said, we need to move this bird bath from here to there. And then, you know, sometimes weeks will go by before the birds are comfortable.
Yeah. Absolutely. Right. Absolutely. And we're starting to hear, if you listen to any of the science programs or read any, you know, and that's the secret side of me. I'm this secret science geek. I love science. I came that close to becoming a marine zoologist. And sometimes I'm sort of sorry puberty hit and got me all confused. But we're hearing so much about not just the intelligence, the remarkable intelligence of the corvids, the crows and the ravens, which they're now, some scientists are now saying these might be some of the smartest creatures on Earth, but that birds, all species of birds, it's like bird brain doesn't matter. That's wrong. Mm-hmm. Birds are extremely intelligent.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about
that. They truly are intelligent. Well, there's just little things that I see in my own backyard that reinforce how incredibly intelligent they are. You know, I know where many of our resident birds go to sleep every night. And they have this whole ritual that they do just to watch out and make sure that predators aren't watching where they go to roost. Yet they go to roost at the same place, same time, every night.
So they chat.
But
what do they do?
So tuned in with their environment. Uh-huh. You know, some will sit up on the top of a tree and they'll make a call occasionally, maybe awaiting some response from someone else for the all clear. Mm-hmm. I've seen a titmice outside my window. I have a butterfly bush outside my office window, and this time of year there are a lot of dead curled leaves, and he systematically goes up and down each branch, opening up with his foot. He'll pull the dead leaf off, tear it apart, and voila, there's an insect. Yet he'll skip other leaves. And I've gone out there to look, and those leaves have nothing in them. So I'm wondering, how does this bird know from the outside that there isn't anything to eat inside that leaf? So they have other levels of intelligence that we're just totally not aware of unless we really stop and pay attention to them.
Yeah, I'm sure you've seen that special, what it was, at the British TV special Life of Birds.
Oh yeah, love that.
What is it, Lord Attenborough who hosts it?
Yeah, fantastic.
I've watched it from beginning to end twice, and I'm ready for a third time.
Yeah.
If you love birds, if we're piquing your interest at all tonight, it's really a stunning. And there's a theme each week, not each week. Each episode has a different theme. The episode on birds as builders. My God, it was amazing.
The world's best architects are
not
birds.
By accident.
Not by accident.
No, by design. On that note, I think we should take a little musical interlude here on Mouthful, and we'll be right back.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to arise. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes and learn to see all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to be free. Blackbird fly, blackbird fly, into the line of a dark black night. Mm-hmm. bed singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to arise. You were only waiting for this moment to arise. You were only waiting for this moment to arise.
It's Mouthful here on KRCB. I'm Michelle Anna Jordan. Thanks for tuning in. We are talking about songbirds, birds in general, and gardens. And I can tell right now from what we should have just done an hour on birds and then done another hour on the school yeah. garden. But very quickly, in a nutshell, what does the Songbird Hospital do?
We are a licensed wildlife rehabilitation facility. So that means that when you find an injured, orphaned, or ill bird, you can bring it to us. And we care for it, give it the medical treatment that it needs. And if it's a baby, we hand raise it and give it all the skills it needs to be released back out to the wild. Cool. So, yeah, we give songbirds a second chance.
Great. And then, Frederick, the classroom garden.
Yeah, we're calling it the garden classroom.
A garden now. Classroom.
We've kind of gone back
backwards.
And,
okay.
Yeah, we've gone back and forth. And
is it part of a department?
Well, the Environmental Studies Department okay. actually sponsors it, but students come from all over campus.
Uh-huh. And what about non-degree students, you know, through the extension program? Are there any programs that provide access to just community members?
Well, and we're really trying to develop this garden to be available to the community and to provide examples of sustainable gardening and not just agriculture. Most universities
yeah.
have agriculture.
Agriculture.
So we do have, you know, vegetable beds and an orchard, but this garden is more like, you know, I call it our giant backyard.
Okay.
And the students really love it, and we're trying to create those connections between, mm-hmm. you know, the creek. The creek flows right past the garden. So, mm-hmm.
And so know, is it run pretty much all by students?
Pretty much, yes. I think we have about 9 interns now, and, you know, our idea is they'll do 2 unit internships in the garden, and that the following semester we can send them out then for the other 2 units to community gardens.
Oh, great.
Which is why I've been talking to the new Ceres garden.
Ceres, yeah. I want to do a whole hour on Ceres sometime
yeah.
soon.
And so they're going to be my test case. I'm
oh,
sending
great.
Them some interns. And a lot of students come and volunteer, then they're getting 5 points extra credit, or they're doing, you know, required community service
uh-huh.
for their classes. And so, yeah, hundreds of students. Fridays are a good day to come by.
Oh, really? Oh, so, and people can come and see?
Yes, yes. And then we cook lunch in the garden.
Oh, really?
Slow food has started to revive their SSU Slow Food Club.
Uh-huh. And so they'll come and they'll cook lunch. Oh, that's great.
Yeah, we're having a lot of fun.
Uh-huh. It sounds like it. Let's, if we can, take an injured bird from the time someone hides it. Someone finds it.
I hope they don't hide it.
No, finds it. Until you release it. And I always love when you had the little shop downtown Main Street in Sebastopol. I'm so sad that it's not there. I love some of the stories of people coming in with, you know, lost birds and shoeboxes.
Yes.
And we also have to make time for the amazing basket you have there.
Oh, yeah. I brought some
show
and tell.
So can I give you the bird example of the injured bird?
Yes.
Because,
give it.
So I'm
it's
sitting in my office at school one day, and a student comes by and thrusts this little thing at me and says, "Here, I found this in the garden, and I don't have time to deal with it," and handed me a baby quail.
Oh.
The cutest little
How
bit
How big is
fluff.
A baby quail?
It was about
like a quarter?
Imagine a gold-colored cotton ball yeah. with 2 toothpicks right. stuffed in the
right.
bottom.
But
and
that's
what it is.
I called Veronica, of course, because and the thing that surprised me is that they don't sit quietly in the little box.
No. They're a high-stress little character. I call them popcorn because they're just constantly bouncing up and down, and they don't stop until they have comfort of several other
little
babies.
So will the stress kill them?
Yes, actually. that's true for a lot of birds in general, particularly songbirds, particularly little baby quail. They're very prone to stress. And so actually, my volunteer, Linda Larson, who specializes in quail, took that little guy, and he was raised with, I think, about 25 others.
Oh, so he survived.
He survived and was safely released somewhere in Sonoma County as a covey. They all went as a covey.
Oh, they did.
But other little guys that are brought to us, you know, they come to us for a variety of different reasons. They're hit by a car, they run into a window, they're caught by a cat. You know, particularly during the breeding season, babies become displaced from tree trimming and brush clearing. So, you know, it depends on the nature of the injury. If it's an injured bird, for example, we had a varied thrush that came in a few weeks ago. He had been caught by a cat. He had a broken leg. He had some serious wounds on his back. And he was with me for a total of 4 weeks. It took about 2.5 weeks for all of his injuries to heal really, really well. And then it took about another 2 weeks for him to go out to the aviary for pre-release conditioning. Plus, he had lost half of his tail feathers in the cat attack.
Were the tail feathers
grow back? Yes, they did grow back. I had to wait, though, before we released him until they were fully grown back, because a tail is a very important part.
Balance
and braking and turning. It's an essential part of their anatomy, really, for flight. So we can't release half-feathered birds.
Yeah. Speaking of a cat attack, mm-hmm. I'm also a cat lover.
Yes.
My cats go outside because I live in the country, mm-hmm. and I don't have... They win. They win.
They say, "Mom, you lose today."
They will make my life. I keep them in from about the 26th, depending on the day of the week, the 26th or 27th of October until the 3rd or 4th of November, because my cats are black. And
it's horrible that you have to worry about that.
Yeah, and I lost my beloved Olive 1 year, and so they don't go out. But my life is hell. They don't get it. So what do you do to stop? What can you do to get your cat to not
it's challenging, because I know every cat is different. Their propensity to hunt is different. It mm-hmm. varies with age and species and personality type for mm-hmm. these guys. We've had some creative things come up in the last few years. I have a couple of people who were regularly bringing me cat caught birds, and you know, I have an obligation to advocate on behalf of my guys,
of course, and
have, you know, conversations about these things with people. And two of them built outdoor cat enclosures. Mm-hmm. One is off somebody's bathroom window, and the other woman has just a big separate enclosure in her backyard, and she just brings her kitties out there during the day, and they have a great time. So I thought, well, that was a brilliant idea if you've got the space. There's a product out now for people who don't have the space to do something like that, and it's called a cat bib. And I do know of one person who purchased the cat bib. It's available online, and it is literally a little neoprene bib that you attach around kitty's neck, and what it does is it blocks the pounce. So when they go to leap, their little paws are blocked from actually capturing the bird. And the woman who bought it for her cat, she called me a couple days later after she had, you know, put it on and tried it out, and she said, "Well, you know, he has some of his dignity has been lost."
Yes.
But he'll get over it, because uh-huh. It was distressing for her that uh-huh. this was going on in her backyard, because she really loved the birds and she had taken down her feeders and everything, and it uh-huh. still wasn't stopping the problem. And she lived in a space where she really couldn't build an outdoor enclosure uh-huh. or couldn't come up with any other sort of solution. So this worked really well for her. Uh-huh. So there are things to do. Bells don't always work, because one, sometimes the cats learn how to tuck the bell under their chin.
They also know how to take it off.
Yeah, they know that too. And it may be effective for adult birds, because they can hear that and eventually associate what that sound may mean. But baby birds, even if they could make the association that the sound of a bell means a cat's coming, they have no ability to get away.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and so also, babies are really vulnerable.
Yeah, I used to think that that was the answer. And then somebody, Jerry from Poodle and Gargoyle, mm-hmm. she mm-hmm. had a collar and bell on her cat, and her cat was hiding from a fox, and the fox found her because of the collar and bell.
Oh, for heaven's sake!
And so I've quit It's like, oh, that's heartbreaking.
Wow.
Totally heartbreaking. So it's like, okay,
gosh,
gotta come up with something.
I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, I was really shocked.
Oh,
and it's like,
dear.
You know, predator, we have more predators because they're in... their environment is shrinking as
yes,
well.
They're getting
and I feel
pushed.
So sad about mountain lion and all that. It's like, no, you know, we're in their space.
Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly.
You know, leave them alone.
That's right.
But that's something to think about. You know, if you
Truly.
Live where it's, you know, where you're out in the country, you might want to consider that.
Yes, yeah.
But the catbib, mm-hmm. that's interesting.
Yeah. I thought it was a really clever idea.
Yeah. So, and, you know, to build a cat enclosure is not as difficult and overwhelming as I once thought. I know that a very important person in my life has, she has three cats right now. She's my kumu hula. And she has a very nice backyard down in Marin. And what she has is just this, it's almost like netting that just goes out about from her fence. If you see the fence, then it comes into the yard at the top of the fence by about 12 inches. So the cats can't jump over the fence.
Perfect, yeah.
Yeah, so she has that all the way around so she can let her, because she's like really paranoid about anything happening to her cats. But she has this so they can go outside all they want.
Right.
But yet they can't jump onto the fence.
Yeah, because they're vulnerable
smart.
Out there too.
Sure.
You know, if you live on we live on a really busy road, and I am always finding casualties.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just not safe for them either to be roaming around in the streets and crossing traffic and things.
Yeah. And there's such a pervasive opinion among a lot of people that they're just animals. You hear, if you listen to talk shows, you hear a lot of that.
Right.
They're like that about birds. They're like that about cats.
Yeah.
And a lot of people are like that about dogs, though mm-hmm. I don't think quite as many. But I think there's still so much education that needs to go on, which is one of the reasons I love what both of you are doing.
Yeah.
So one thing we haven't talked about that much yet is the drought. And clearly I'm going to do that again. We've talked about it a little bit. But if somebody wants to start planting or has planted and wants to keep on planting this year, is there a good resource for them? Or are there just a few core things they should know because of this different weather?
I think it's really important to mulch. And I also think that when you are going to plant, to make sure that your soil is moist before you plant. And then to, usually when I'm going to plant something, I soak it in a bucket of water.
The little plant.
And even the small plants, gallon pots, whatever it is, I usually dunk it completely. And you'll see little bubbles rise up. And when the bubbles are finished rising, the soil is saturated, and then I plant.
Mm-hmm.
I think often people will go out, they're so excited, oh, I got a six-pack of lettuce, and they go out there, the soil is dry, you plunk those poor little cubes in the ground.
And 2 weeks later, you find the cube in exactly right. the same position.
Right, and so I think it's important, and mulching is really critical.
What do you recommend using for mulch?
You know, you can use straw. Be careful you don't buy hay, which is
right.
full of seeds.
You want straw, not hay.
Right. And the
what
other,
about the rice?
Rice straw is wonderful.
Okay.
It actually doesn't break down as quickly, and so that's nice. And the other thing is if you're growing something that likes a lot of nitrogen, alfalfa, which is a legume. And
that doesn't have a lot of seeds?
No, but okay. what it will do is release some nitrogen.
Oh, cool.
Some people who love roses like to spread it around the roses.
I'm going to go get some because I love roses. What about, have you ever gardened in a straw bale?
You know, I haven't, but I've seen gardens.
I just downloaded, a few months ago, I bought a book online.
Mm-hmm.
This guy from the Midwest did this whole mm-hmm. little booklet on how to garden actually in straw bales.
Wow.
And it's recommend if you have a back problem, for example, because you're not mm-hmm. bending over so much. But I'm attracted to it for two reasons. One, I had to buy a bunch of straw bales for Halloween,
mm-hmm.
for a Halloween party, so there you go. But also, it seems a really good hedge against Sebastopol gophers.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I thought, as soon as you said that, I thought, I bet gophers don't.
Gophers, yes.
Yeah,
gophers are not
going
to burrow
into
up into
right,
the straw.
Right.
So you have to. It takes about 10 to 14 days to season them. Mm-hmm. And I haven't done it yet. I thought, well, with this cold weather, I'm going to wait.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to start seasoning them this month
yeah.
and then see what I can do. And then once they disintegrate, you can, you know, you've got all that great straw going into the ground. You can get just more bales to put on top.
Right. You know, a few years ago at Sonoma State, we needed to get our compost under control. It's an ongoing problem for us. But somebody came along and built us this compost bin out of straw bales. And it was wonderful. It actually had, you know, three separate sections, and we piled all the stuff in the middle. And by the time that the compost has, you know, really finished, the bales are starting to break down a bit. And
what a great idea.
Interesting idea.
Yeah,
I love this.
That's
like, you know, using those in that way.
That's a really, okay, I'm going to use that too. Mm-hmm. That's a really, what about worms?
Which one?
Worms. Did you say you hate worms?
Likes worms?
Oh, I love worms.
Yeah, I have several million worms. I'm raising worms.
Good job.
I got a friend built me what looks like a pine coffin, mm-hmm. and with holes in the bottom.
Right.
And I bought some worms, but somebody at the farmer's market also gave me worms, and for. Mm-hmm. God, for several months now, I've kept a tarp folded up on top of it in case it rains. Probably why it hasn't rained much. I bought a raincoat and I put a tarp.
Thanks, Michelle.
Yeah, it's all my fault. But it keeps it warm. And I open that up, and in those first minutes when my eyes are focusing, it looks like it's boiling.
Yeah. Wow.
And that's because worms are top feeders, but they're feeders in the dark. Mm-hmm. So when it's dark in there, they are all the way at the top eating everything. And it's amazing. If either of you want any worms, you know.
So I do want some worms.
Okay.
And I did an article about worms.
Yeah, was this for, you write for Pacific Horticulture.
Yeah, and so for Darwin's 200th birthday, he was, you know, he was our first actual worm scientist.
Oh, really?
And which I found really interesting. He was interested in worms for his entire life. And people thought they were pests. And he's the person who changed that.
I did not know it was Darwin.
And that article's available online.
PacificHorticultural.org.com?
Yeah, .org.
Okay.
What I found out as I was writing that article is that there are actually three kinds of earthworms. Amy Stewart did a
Amy? She was here.
Right.
She wrote that book.
The about earthworms.
The Earth Moved.
Right.
And she was on the show right after the book came out. Well, the book has been re-released.
Yeah.
It's been released by Welcome Books. It's in their spring catalog. So I'm actually going to look for that interview with Amy. I have it somewhere.
Right.
So
it's, you know, so, but you know, the thing about the worms, so the ones you're talking about, the red wigglers, they actually like to live at the interface between the top of the soil and the organic matter, and they break down organic matter mm-hmm. really well. Most earthworms don't actually eat a lot of soil except by accident.
Right, yeah, they're eating organic matter.
Right, there's one kind. And then the night crawlers, which are not native here and cause big problems in some areas back east, they actually live much further down in the soil, and then they come up at night and they pull things down.
So you're adding that, you're getting the organic matter deeper.
Right.
And we wouldn't be here if it wasn't for worms. It's worms that create topsoil.
Mm-hmm.
Without topsoil, we couldn't grow anything.
Right,
Oh, yeah, they had no earthworms at all back east.
They don't?
No. Well, they didn't.
Oh, they didn't.
They all died after the last period of glaciation. And so in the forests in Minnesota, these earthworms have become a huge problem because the duff there decomposes very slowly in the forests. And it's supposed to decompose slowly there and make this nice thick leaf litter. A lot of the wildflowers rely on that. And the night crawlers are so voracious that they decompose all of that too quickly.
Oh.
And there are vast areas now of forests there with no understory.
Oh, wow.
That is so interesting.
It is. I was fascinated when I found out.
That's kind of
really.
And so their educational problem is convincing people who like to fish to
please, use night crawl, go dig up some worms.
Well, don't leave your bait in the woods. And so I'm always telling people that now about where we live. Don't take these worms out, and we don't know what they're going to do out in the redwoods or something.
Right. Oh, really? Really interesting.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, and Amy's book is fabulous.
It's a really good book. She's doing really well. She's written several since then, and she's extremely successful.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be trying to rebroadcast that interview. Time flies. Our hour is almost up, if you can believe that. If people find a bird, what's the first thing they should? I just want to do a real condensed version. You open the door, the cat's sitting there with a bird in its mouth. You get it out of its mouth, it's not dead.
Yes.
What next?
The next thing you want to do is safely contain the bird. Find
a little shoebox,
even a paper grocery bag with some air holes, something like that. Keep it warm, dark, and quiet. Don't give it any food or water, and then call us.
What's your number?
It's 707-484-6502.
484-6502.
Yes.
Anytime?
Anytime between 8 a.m. and 8 p.m.
Okay.
Every day of the week.
Good. Okay. And then let's say you find it at 9:30 at night. What should you do during that time period?
Right. So birds are just like us. They're diurnal, so they sleep at night. So just find a really nice, quiet, warm place in your home to keep it overnight safely, and then call us in the morning.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
And then you don't go pick up. They bring to you.
This time of year, I very often go pick up.
Oh, you do? Okay.
During the baby season, it's a little hard for me to leave the property because we have a lot of patients in care. So most of the time, we're dependent on the public to bring us the birds at that time.
Okay. Now, all important for you, how is the Songbird Hospital funded?
We are funded entirely by donations. So we don't receive money from the county or the state or the federal government. It's entirely by donations.
How do people donate to you?
They can certainly call us, or they can look up our website, songbirdhospital.org, and our mailing address is on there. And there are lots of donation ideas, including just wish list items that we always need.
Oh, excellent. Oh, that's great. So if always you can make a cash donation, but you can go to songbirdhospital.org. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you got stuff you're going to take to a flea market or give away, check first.
Yes.
Check first.
Bath towels.
I am going to do
that. Faded. We love those.
Okay. When I get home tonight, I'm going to look.
I have a pile.
Can people ever come see you?
We're not open to the public. Fish and Game stipulates via our permit that we cannot put our animals on exhibit.
Okay.
But we do try and actively keep our Facebook page updated with
you have
patient
great
photos
photographs.
So people can see what we're up to. And then certainly if anyone is interested in volunteering, we're having an orientation on March 11th from 11:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. And we're actually going to host it at the Sebastopol Community Center because we don't have a lot of parking at the Songbird Hospital. And that's another way to get a close-up look
at
what we do.
That's a great idea. So Songbird Hospital volunteer orientation.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to put that in my column.
Great.
That's a great thing. Absolutely. Frederick, how do people get more information or find their way to the garden on a Friday to come visit?
So the garden is in the northwest corner of the campus. It's only $2.50 to park. If you want to come on a weekend, it's free. And we have a good map online, mm-hmm. so you can
find your way. Online, ssu.org.
.edu.
Yes.
And it's LAV as in Victor, OIP as in Peter, IE.
Lavoie-Pierre. Stands for Rocky Road.
And, and so
it stands for, translated, it's Rocky
and
Road.
So they truncated my name. But you can also find me through our university preserves who administrate my programs. And so through entomology outreach, you can kind of make your way to.
Yes.
To
and you can always go to Mouthful's Facebook page, ask any questions that you like. I will post contact information there sometime this evening. You can also send me an email at catsmilk@sonic.net. There were so many questions. I have. We'll have to talk off the air, and we'll have to have both of you back. Thanks so much for tuning in. Meet me back here next week for another yummy episode of Mouthful, the Wine Country's Most Delicious Hour. Have a great week.
To the Lord that praises me, it's time for dinner now. Let's go eat. We've got some beans and some good cornbread. Now listen to what the preacher said.
Mouthful is produced by Michelle Anna Jordan. It's engineered by Lawrence Alberti and Eric Black. For more information about Mouthful, email to catsmilk@sonic.net. That's catsmilk@sonic.net. You can also go to krcb.org and download podcasts of Mouthful, as well as from iTunes.
And the moral of this story, children, it is plain but true. God knows if a preacher preaches long enough, even he'll get hungry too, and he'll sing
to the Lord that praises me.